Welcome back. I'm Peter Wood, and I'm the author of Mud Between Your Toes, A Rhodesian Farm, which is a memoir about my life growing up in Zimbabwe, or formerly Rhodesia, in the 1960s and 70s. This is a podcast about family, independence, loss, and above all, identity. When my brother Duncan was born at the Lady Chancellor Hospital in 1959, my father and his best friend Gerry von Memmerty turned up rather late and a little worse for wear. They found the corridor barred by a stern-looking matron, hands upon her broad hips and starched cornet perched upon her head. "Only husbands or fathers beyond here," she growled, one eyebrow raised, chins a-quiver. As quick as a flash, Gerry responded, "Well, he's the husband, and I'm the father." Of course, she found this so amusing that she let them pass, giggling like two little naughty schoolboys. My father crossed the darkened ward and congratulated my mum by handing her a stick of half-eaten biltong. To the uninitiated, biltong is beef jerky. My father was always the romantic type. My mother, recovering from a caesarean, was the only patient without flowers, and many of the white dames in the ward must have thought she was some kind of fallen woman. By the time I arrived in 1962, it was my mother's third C-section in as many years. Complications arrived from my being 7 weeks premature meant that my father was asked to choose to save the mother or the child if things took a turn. My father chose the mother. Of course, somewhat typical of my mother's spooky side of the family, she told us that during the birth she had undergone an otoscopic or out-of-body experience where she found herself levitating above her own body. She watched with morbid satisfaction while the surgeon cut into her and removed this tiny little baby. She claims that she could hear the doctors discussing, clear as day, whether she was going to live or die. Naturally, this expérience de mort imminente, or silver thread as it's commonly known, had a profound effect on her relationship with her little baby boy. And so began my life on a southern African farm. Do you know, it was a childhood of great freedom beneath the enormous Lomagundi skies, but at the same time, very constricted by decades of rigid colonial norms and a brutal personal civil war. To the north, the sluggish Hanyani River ran towards the Zambezi, and to the east, the deep Umsengedzi River wound its way to Mozambique. And to the south flowed the green Msitwi River, from which our farm took its name. And like a scar through the heart of the country ran the Great Dyke, known in our district as the Mbukwi Range, and to the west, the smoky blue Ayrshire Hills of Rafangora. Nestled in a peaceful valley among these features was Msitwi Farm. Now, more than four decades after my birth, I find myself again passing through Mbukwi's village, which used to be neat with little crocodiles of uniformed schoolchildren in khaki shorts or green gingham dresses, felt cloche hats pulled down over the brow. The clipped hedgerows and tiny mown lawns that grew right to the edge of the road have now been replaced by litter. Gosh, it was quite surprising. Food wrappers and pages of the Zimbabwe Herald fluttered against chain-link fences. Broken flip-flops made in China, or known locally as ching-chongs. And the ubiquitous plastic bags, the scourge of Africa, lie scattered at the Matambanadzo bus stop. Flap, 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 flapping in the wind. My brother navigates the Land Rover around a pothole big enough to break the axle. Still, I'm surprised how well-maintained the roads are in the village. In the back, my 76-year-old mother sits quietly, an occasional gasp, or, "Oh God, look at that," punctuating the cabin. I question whether I should have bullied her into coming. I thought it might prove cathartic, but now, I don't know, I have my reservations. Certain landmarks spur her into humorous stories or dreary reminiscences. Others make her go silent and broody. My brother occasionally glances across at me and raises his eyebrows in a manner that suggests, "I told you so." "It'll do her good," I mumble. "I heard that," my mother says. "I'm not dead, you know." A Zimbabwe flag still flies proudly at the post office, the colours rather faded. Fred Youngman's, the butcher, is now closed and shuttered. The gas station without fuel. "I'll give you the grand tour," Duncan says. "It'll take about 3 minutes." His laugh booms through the cabin. We drive past the Mbuki's clinic, teeming with people, women with toddlers balancing on their hips or babies tied on their backs, some with both. A clinic that offers hope, but is now dark without power and without Muti. And in the gloom, the indomitable Dr. Sotoli and his nurses soldier on despite the cutbacks. Not even a bottle of aspirin on the empty shelves. "God, I had to take a woman there last week," my brother says, gesturing as we drive past. Inside the corridors of the clinic, it was so dark you could only see people when they laughed or opened their eyes. The spa store was open, with people lounging on its steps, loudly talking into mobile phones, and Bira Chimurenga music could be heard coming from the store, booming from old battery-operated ghetto blasters. You know, it's very strange driving through a village that has no power, but still resonates with activity. People come and go as usual. Their lives have to go on. But the darkness inside the shops is troubling. You know, I mean, Mbukwe's had never been a picturesque town. It was like any frontier farming town. But now, as plastic bags sweep across the road, one gets a sense that the old world lay buried beneath the litter. Not too deep, but out of sight. If you scratched the surface, you might find something from the past. Fragments of a time gone by, shattered like a mirror, but still barely visible. I noticed the occasional SUV or farm pickup, covered in dust, possibly from one of the few remaining farmers eking out a living in nearby Forrester Estate. An elderly white man, hobbling on a cane near the Mulvan House home for the elderly, gives Dunk a wave as we drive past. Duncan toots the horn. "Christ, he's aged," Duncan says. "Poor old bugger." Mbukwe's, and indeed Zimbabwe, tatty as it may be, has largely escaped the urban scribble of American graffiti. If any, the graffiti's political, a few for the MDC, which is the open hand, and largely ZANU-PF, which is the closed fist. The stencils or imprints of flat open palms plastered against walls, rocks and trees imply that the opposition party, the MDC, was still alive, albeit underground. "This is ZANU-PF territory," Duncan explains. "Few people in the village would dare give the MDC salute." The farmers' co-op renamed the farm and city, bustles with shoppers. The place still just worked. Just, I say. The post office is, as always, painted in its government colours of jade green and cream. Indestructible police camp flowers, which I think their real name is Madagascar peony, struggle to survive along the pathway lined with whitewashed rocks. Do you know those Madagascar peonies? They grow all over the colonial world, and you'll see them outside every institution. They literally are the indestructible flower of the world. God, I hated them because they stood for everything that was institutional. The Zim Postal Service is still the best lifeline to the rest of the world. Incredibly, despite all the difficulties in Zimbabwe, the service actually works. In a place where all other governmental organizations seem to be riddled with corruption and incompetence. If you were patient, you might even call the postal services efficient. Children and family members who had taken the gap to the UK, USA, and South Africa. Now, taking the gap means running for the hills, basically. Anyway, people who had taken the gap still sent back parcels and hampers of goods from Walmart, M&S, Asda, and Sainsbury's. Goodies such as candles and matches, vacuum-packed rice, canned goods such as sardines or tuna, basic stuff to live on. Not the old kind of hampers from Fortnum's that were stuffed full of quality streets and cashmere jerseys and long, ghastly scarves knitted lovingly by some maiden aunt in Surrey. Nowadays, airmail took 3 or 4 weeks, but the mail always got through in the end. And the Mvukwis, just like the country itself, ticked over, albeit haphazardly. ZANU-PF posters hung on fences, flapping in the wind, the bespectacled face of President Mugabe peering out behind his characteristic spectacles, more like a schoolteacher than a dictator. A pair of bush doves roosting above the posters left a series of white splatters across his face, hiding those intense, beady eyes. We drive past the grain depot, now empty apart from a few lonely sacks of unidentified grain used by some NGO hoping to make some kind of difference, I suppose, or at the very least make some philanthropic billionaire sleep better at night because he had given something back. One of the biggest grain depots in the country, and now, wow, how depressing, reduced to a few sacks of mealies. And then suddenly we're through the village, in minutes, and back on the road to the V block, which is short for the Victory Block. "Shouldn't we be turning right?" I asked my brother. "Nah," he says, "the road through the Birkdale Pass is buggered, washed away in the last rainy season. We have to go around via Maturashanga. It's a pain in the arse, but safer. And anyway, you get the scenic route today." The road council hasn't been paid in over 6 months, so all repairs are done by us. I'm disappointed. That journey through the Birkdale Pass was ingrained in my memory. But we drive on in silence past so many farms that used to belong to friends, now mostly derelict and empty. There's a beauty to the countryside that is, well, it's hard to pinpoint. Where the agriculture has vanished, the bush has crept back in to reclaim what once belonged to it, I suppose. The Mvukwi's countryside is breathtaking. I'd really forgotten. I imagine that it's the old Mvukwis from before white man arrived. That's what it looks like now. Before we ploughed up the land to plant our foreign seeds and tore up the hillsides for minerals and ores. All along the drive, the stunning range known as the Great Dyke rises above the plateau and continues unbroken to the horizon. Once through the dyke, we pass through the Maturashanga mining town with its row upon row of tin huts, identical except each street is painted in a different pastel colour. They like beach huts in Brighton, I think to myself. Row upon row, pinks and baby blues and lavender and lemons. The mine towns are still good owing to the Chinese influence. For miles we can see alluvial mining on either side of the road, huge tracts of land where the topsoil has literally been removed and sifted for rare earth minerals. Sadly, the land never recovers and very little ever grows in the barren earth. And along the dike, deep red scars from dozens of prospectors can be seen. The hills look as if they're bleeding. I thought all this had been banned in the 70s, all this alluvial mining.
So did I, said Duncan, but I reckon the Chinese money talks around here.
He gestures towards a corrugated iron hoarding with the words Sino-Steel Corporation written in Chinese and in English on one side.
Is that one of yours? He asks with a wry grin.
We pass a massive truck emblazoned with the same Chinese characters and loaded down the soil, the huge wheels barely fitting on the narrow tar road.
You see that? Dunk continues. They just take all the topsoil, as it is, and ship the whole bloody lot back to China in great containers. Nothing is left.
Even Africa has been shipped away, truckload by truckload. After the mining town, the going gets a bit more picturesque, but also much harder and slower. The roads become dirt and rocky, and places they're washed away entirely. We change into four-wheel drive. What once might have taken, 20 minutes now takes nearly an hour. The gears and the wheels grinding against the surface. This is the Sipililo Loop Road, and it was the main artery adjoining the two massive farming areas of Rafangora and Mvukwes. It seems time has stood still. All along the way, things are familiar from when we used to travel this road almost every day. Every corner, every farm, every African store were part of our everyday lives. And here and there the tarmac peeps shyly through the gravel, reminding us what the road used to be like. God, it was never particularly good at the best of times, those roads. But now it's just a series of gullies and exposed rocks. The Girdlestones farmhouse burnt to the ground. Dave Dolphin's store, roofless and dark. Cyril Hall's farm, deserted. My heart begins to pound as we near the Masitwe halt. And there it is, across the valley to my left, the farm I grew up on. A sea of green trees and granite kopjes, and the bald kopje forming the centerpiece. God, the beauty is breathtaking.
Good Lord, just look at that. I'd quite forgotten how staggering it really was, my mum says.
She speaks in the past tense. This part of her life is finished. We stop briefly to survey the landscape. No one speaks for a while. A line of young women, colourful in their sarongs, baskets and enamel dishes balanced upon their heads, file past. They smile, as if seeing a four-wheel drive down these parts is quite normal. Beyond the valley, the tall rock edifice of Matimba, the tallest peak in the V-block. And then in the distance, the extraordinary rhino-shaped kopje alongside Bagaziwa on Kelston Ranch, tower out of the grey bushveld. My mother is leaning back in the seat, her usual chatter gone. We drive on and 10 minutes later arrive at the barns of Masitwe Farm. It looks like a war zone. Honestly, all the corrugated iron roofing had gone from the sheds. Walls have caved in places. Pigweed and blackjacks have taken hold in unruly bunches along the edge of the walls and across the yard. The old fuel shed with its ancient spoke-wheeled window stands alone, all the other walls having crumbled around it. Perhaps what's most disturbing is the silence. Only the crunch of our wheels on the gravel. No chickens,
No women carrying babies, no tractors, no hammering or singing or cursing. No noise at all. Nothing. No one. We engage first gear and head up the hill. This is the final stretch before the old house. As soon as Duncan switches off the engine, I'm immediately and overwhelmingly engulfed by the silence. Utter silence. Something I haven't experienced for a long time. Somehow the ticking of the engine as it cools seems to make the silence even more palpable. I sit back in the car, my sweaty back sticking to the seat, and quietly take in my surroundings. It seems that not a cricket nor a bush dove breaks the solitude. Midday on the African savannah and the world is asleep. Duncan looks across at me. Shit, man, I told you we shouldn't have come here. My eyes move slowly over the flat-topped flamboyant trees, a few bright red blooms dried and scorched on the earth. A spiny dead jacaranda, listing to one side, has fallen into the remains of a security fence. No one's bothered to move it. It lies like a skeleton across the chain link. And ahead, a burst of colour from a lilac bougainvillea, clawing its way over the tumbled wrought iron gate, uprooting and twisting the rusted support beams in their path. There's no grass to speak of, just the hard, arid earth and a few sad patches of what used to be a lush, irrigated lawn. A small dust devil gathers up a few leaves and eddies across the baked earth before petering out, the leaves floating back down to the dirt. This is the dry season, and it seems that the entire country just holds its breath for those first quenching, exhilarating drops of rain. And above, the endless, eternal azure blue sky, cloudless. I look up towards the house, hidden behind some overgrown creepers, a mess of morning glory, and some periwinkle blue plumbago blossoms peep out from the weeds, remnants of a once fragrant garden. God, I stare for what seems like several minutes, both horrified and fascinated. And then I see the woman. The car must have woken her. I doubt if many visitors pass this way, if ever. A bright polyester headscarf and a shiny sarong bound tightly around her waist. I suppose I expect or wish that she would look as poverty-stricken as her home. She stands for a second beyond the twisted gate. Obviously someone's driven into it, no one's bothered to make any repairs. She adjusts the child on her back, observing me. There's no animosity, just a slight surprise to be receiving a visitor at this time of day. You're on your own now, Butt. Just go in. You don't have to ask permission. This is our home anyway, mumbles Duncan. My mum remains in the car, in the darkness. The woman says nothing, just stands there adjusting the strap, carrying the baby on her back. So I open the car door and approach the gate. Hello? How are you? I say, rather pointlessly. I look up towards the house. I used to live here. This, I say, waving my hands around me, was my home. I was just wondering if I could look around. She cuts me short by peering over my shoulder at my mother and brother in the Land Rover. A vague recognition passes over her face, maybe a memory of when they fought for possession of this place. Where have you come from? I'm from Hong Kong. I used to live here. Yes, I know, she cuts in. You have already told me. She's looking me over. Her face gives nothing away. She emits an almost audible sigh and then shrugs in an African way that means, well, just means anything from resignation to annoyance. All right, come. Her accent is thick, but clearly educated. She turns to leave, walking back behind the house to where the servants used to sit out, gesturing me to go via the front and have a look. God, my stomach is in knots. No longer sure whether this was such a good idea. As if in a dream, I glide towards the gate, my hand touching the rusted metal handle. Sliding it across, just enough force and a slight lift of the gate with my foot gets the latch gliding across without grating. That much I remember. God, I had done it countless times, particularly late at night when we wanted to sneak in after a drinking session at the club. Silly, really, because everyone could hear the car coming up the hill anyway. Masitui. Masitui Farm. Masitui House. I take in a deep breath. What an amazing house. I'd almost forgotten. Across from me, the lawns have been dug up and planted with sweet potatoes and neat ridges, a few pumpkins creeping between the furrows. The view is shielded by a patch of tall mealies. I step up to the veranda. It seems huge now that is devoid of furniture or pot plants or hunting trophies. A giant pink and white bougainvillea has pulled down half the ceiling near where I'm standing. I look up into the cavernous roof, half expecting to see the little family of civets that used to reside there. They're the cutest little things and always used to come out when we had our evening drink. The ceiling boards in this part of the house are decayed, falling down or rotted away. An old rusted tractor's been backed up onto the fucking veranda. Across the top of the support beams, my mum's fancy brookie lace wrought iron borders now hang down at odd angles. Brookie lace being the Afrikaans word for fancy panties. These once treasured pieces of colonial Rhodesiania, now impractical, unloved and unwanted, I suppose. Footpaths crisscross between the furrows of crops towards various parts of the garden, disappearing over the lip of the hill into an impenetrable mass of weeds and creepers where our water garden once trickled and gurgled down to deep green ponds full of bream and large mutant goldfish. Jesus, those goldfish, they'll take your finger off if they could. They've all long since gone, taken by greedy garden centres in Harare. And towards one side of the house stands the cottage. Washing hangs limply outside. And a massive blue Petria volubus once adorned the front of that cottage. Petrias are Africa's version of the wisteria. Now the building appears uninviting and dark. Several window panes are smashed. Yet the cottage seems more inhabited than the main house. Perhaps this is where the woman lives. A shadow passes across the threshold. It's a young child, no more than, I don't know, 5 or 6. His naked tummy protrudes from a pair of tatty khaki shorts. "Do you live here?" I ask. He points to the small cottage. This house, it is too big, I don't like," he says. I smile at him and walk off the veranda towards the swimming pool and, God, I'm disturbed to see the empty mosaic kidney-shaped pool, now a stinking shallow puddle of brackish water. Grecian pillars have fallen amongst the creepers, a bit like a lost civilization, I suppose. A peeling granite dolphin, its mouth agape, never again to trickle bubbling water into the sparkling blue pool. Mealies are growing right up to the edge of the pool. It shocks me. Swimming pools. You know, swimming pools are the one thing that seem to incite the liberal press overseas. The thought of wealthy landowners sunbathing beside their pools, gin eternally clasped in manicured hands, a tray of Mazoe orange juice, ice and refreshments under the cool gazebo, sliced lemons in a saucer and the fizz of tonic in one's nose, the aroma of meat roasting on a nearby braai, the smell of the water as it splashes from the garden boy's hose onto the flower beds. The garden boy, always hovering, always wanting to cop a look at the girls sunbathing in their bikinis. My God, I shake my head in an attempt to kickstart my memories. It's like discovering some sad and forgotten Roman ruin. More than anything else, this upsets me the most. The swimming pool. The way the bush and poor agriculture has replaced the verdant lawns. The borders of flowers, the hanging baskets, and the laughter of children all gone. I'm startled by the child who approaches me silently from behind. He giggles and gestures for me to follow him into the house. I don't think this kid has any political view. He just sees me as some odd and maybe hopefully exciting stranger in his home. I quickly look around me. There appear to be no adults around, so I follow him into my old bedroom. I find myself shivering despite the midday heat. It surprises me that the bedroom is so neat and tidy. But it's someone else's clothes that I found so disturbing, folded better than I ever did. The rickety beds neatly made and the floors clean and well swept, apart from some ugly black stains up the walls, which is probably from burning paraffin heaters. I walk to the back window and peer out. A group of adults sit around the old boiler, chatting amiably. The child tugs my sleeve. He wants me to see more. Quickly, I walk through the corridor to my parents' room. This room is uninhabited. I'm shocked by the emptiness. With no pictures on the walls, my eyes fall on the small, neat hole made by a bullet from my rifle. God, it just gives me a shiver. I'd nearly killed her that day with an accidental discharge. I'm going to talk about that later. I make my way back to the sitting room at the end of the long L-shaped veranda. My hand lightly touches the cool cement of a half wall. We used to have a blue floral cushion here. God, I'm starting to get a bit soppy. This is where we had our afternoon tea and evening drinks. My eyes dart from place to place, not wanting to miss anything, searching for clues, memories, visions. I'm trying to soak everything in. And the slate floor, swept but unpolished. I always remember that slate floor. It always smelt of cobra polish. I silently walk into the sitting room. I don't remember it being so large and cavernous. Surprisingly, the ceiling in this room is intact and still looks magnificent. Antique moulded tin taken from the Grand Hotel in Salisbury after it had been pulled down. Although too young to know the Grand Hotel, I had seen an old poster dated 1940 advertising 100 modern rooms. You experience real comfort when you stay at the Grand. Grand Hotel Grill Room, only one of its kind in Rhodesia. The poster also featured a wonderful, proud, three-story structure with elaborate cornices, wrought iron balconies, and a spire. The woman returns. I feel I need to say something, so I point to the ceiling and tell her about its history. I'm pleasantly surprised when she asks me questions. Which Grand? Bulawayo or Salisbury? How would she know that, I wonder? Ah, Salisbury was it. Such a nice hotel. I look at her, wanting to hate her. She tilts her head to one side like a knowing great aunt. My son is at Wits University, she says absently while running a finger along a shelf looking for dust. Then lovingly touching a framed photo. She points to the picture of a proud young man in an ill-fitting suit. Then she looks at me and simply raises her eyebrows. I know what she's getting at. Don't take me as a fool is what she really means. She's not being judgmental, though. Sorry, I say, but I didn't catch your name. Kangachepe, she says. Mrs. Kangachepe. Kangachepe, the bitch who made my mother's life hell. Looking at her now, she seems anything but a bitch. For some reason, and despite everything, I don't blame her. Too much time has passed. Did she know my mother was in the car? I quickly move on. My feet have left dust marks along the parquet flooring, now lying uncared for and unwaxed, yet still all in place. How often I'd heard the sound of bare feet running along the surface, the laughter of children as they scampered to the dining room to get some sweets from the silver dish, or maybe a peach if they were in season. I imagine the sound of a dog barking and the splash of water as someone dives into the cooling aquamarine of the swimming pool. My mind is running wild. Light streams through the bay windows at the far end of the room, dust motes caught in the afternoon rays. One pane is covered now with a yellow fertilizer bag. A fan above my head, now covered in cobwebs, useless without electricity. Geckos scuttle across the walls, hunting for food. I search for the huge, piebald, territorial male gecko that used to rule the roost on these walls. The largest I've ever seen, at almost 9 inches long. He was like a baby croc. But of course he was long gone, pushed from his perch by more agile young guns. I smile at the thought of my mum constantly going around straightening the pictures. Bloody gecko, she would moan. It's rather incongruous. Someone sticky taped tourist posters to the walls. Visit Canada and the Rockies, and another with some azure lake in Switzerland fringed with snowy peaks. On the far wall, my eye rests upon a shape, and I take my breath when I realise that it's where the old leopard skin had been, the outline of the cat clearly visible against the pale cream of the wall. An old picture of me when I was 4 or 5 actually shows me standing next to the dead beast, before it had been skinned, of course, its head resting against my leg, my right arm holding a rifle taller than me. That leopard had been culled because it had become a cattle killer. After all, this was a working farm. People need to understand that. And its skin had adorned our wall for as long as I can remember. I look up towards the long passageway that leads from the dining room to the kitchen, half expecting the sound of clatter and chatter coming from Fred or Conda. The clip of my mother's shoes on the black and white lino, or the tinkle of the bell summoning Conda to bring the main course. Bloody hell, it's all coming back to me. I move back onto the veranda, really quite choked with memories. The doorway from the veranda to the sleeping area is just a wooden frame, the door nowhere to be seen. But I can still see the yellow paint speckled around the edge of the door frame and the faded notches made with a Bowie knife labelled Mandy, Dunk and Pete. As we got taller and taller, the notches got higher and higher. I glance back towards my old room as if seeing a ghost and, without thinking, turn and stride across the veranda, over the dry lawn to the waiting vehicle. I didn't thank Kangachepe. She didn't care. She had already disappeared around the back of the house, the servants' quarters. It's getting late and I don't want to be on the road after dusk. So without asking, Dunk takes off, skirting around the gaping hole that was once a cattle grid, past the space where our stable stood, and accelerates down the road. Tears well up in my eyes, blurring my vision. Stop. Please just stop, my mother commands from the back seat, quietly but firmly. Duncan slams on the brakes. Dust engulfs the vehicle and waits while we gather ourselves. For me, this trip has been educational, selfish for sure, a way of putting something to bed, if an entire lifetime can simply be put to bed. But for Mum, oh, for Mum, it's been catastrophic. Emotional at the best of times. Now she's traumatized. Are you okay, Lib? I asked. I always call my mum Lib. She looks across at me and squeezes my shoulder. It should be me comforting her. Her eyes are shielded by dark sunglasses, her neck taut, her hand across her chest as if trying to slow down her heartbeat. And then she gasps and points. Good God, look at that. I follow her gaze. Ahead is a stretch of arable land, now just a field of overgrown insidious pigweed and scrubby thorn bush. But there on the horizon stands the majestic, impossible beauty of the bald copy, jutting above the smaller granite hills like a monument to eternity. And from behind the bald copy rises the most breathtaking blood moon, sometimes known as a hunter's moon, created by lunar eclipses in another hemisphere. Rare, extraordinary, and certainly biblical. The sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the great and dreadful day of the Lord comes, Mum whispers rather dramatically. For several minutes, we sit in absolute silence watching the gorgeous phenomena casting its light across the landscape. Do you know something, Duncan? That house is not our home. What I saw back there was just bricks. Duncan raises his eyebrows and rolls his eyes, but says nothing. I glance back towards the old house, now hidden behind creaking bamboos and a leafless mafuti tree. The African bush seems to have swallowed it up, gone like one of those early morning dreams you can almost put your finger on, but by breakfast has faded into distant memory. Okay, I say, let's go. Well, that's about it. Thank you so much for listening to me. And remember, you can tune into my new episodes of Mud Between Your Toes via iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Blueberry, and Pocket Casts. Don't forget, you can always buy a copy of my book on both Amazon and Kindle. And I also welcome comments by email on mudbetweenyourtoes@gmail.com. If you want to get involved and you have a good story to tell about those years in Rhodesia, and if you're brave enough to be interviewed for Mud Between Your Toes, feel free to write to me. Goodbye.